Welcome to Career Tools. Strategic time management for contractors. Here we go. This cast answers these questions. How do I make sure I make a good living being a contractor? How much time do I need to spend prospecting as a contractor? How do I make time for training as a contractor? If you want to answer to these questions and more, keep listening.
If you're thinking about interviewing anytime soon, now is the time to start preparing. Interviewing is not about smarts. It's not about personality. It's all about preparation in the modern age as more and more companies use more and more tools to separate the wheat from the chaff. Our interviewing series is over 50 podcasts that go through in detail every step of the interview, how to prepare, how to dress, resumes, cover letters, how to chit-chat, how to answer tell me about yourself and your leadership style and significant accomplishments with repeated examples, how to close, how to ask questions, how to follow up, everything in enormous detail because we know interviewing for most people is a black box. Come and check it out.
Contractors can find themselves, Wendy, with long, unwanted gaps between contracts. They can find themselves left behind when the permanent staff get trained on new technology, and they don't have the time or money to do so. That's hard unless you proactively manage it. So today, Wendy, you're going to tell us how to apply the rule of thirds to your time.
Yeah. For contractors or consultants, I guess, since they have a similar workflow. So we're going to talk about working one third of the time, prospecting one third of the time, and taking professional development a third of the time. So we're just going to divide the time into three, the time over a year or the time over a few months, depending on where you are in the year and what's going on. As long as you're looking at a period of time, then divide it into three. And we're going to divide it between work, prospecting, and professional development.
All right. So the first third is working. So yeah, so actually you got to do some work sometime, right?
Yeah, actually you have to work on a contract. That's kind of the way it goes. But when you plan out the year, often people plan out a year at the beginning of the year, or they plan out the year ahead when they finish a contract, or they have a vacation and then they start planning when they get back. And the mistake that I've seen people do is they plan as if the next contract they get is going to be a year long. And so they're going to be working all of those weeks. And it's just not the case. For a start, contractors are often forced to have vacation in inverted commas. Contracts can look like they're going to stay forever and then they'll change. Circumstances at home might change and mean that you can't be a contractor anymore, or that you need some time off that you didn't expect. So there's all sorts of things that are happening that may mean that you don't work the full year that you expect. And if you've planned for a full year, when you did your income, hopefully when you planned, you were thinking about finances. If you plan for an entire year's income and you only end up working 3 months or 4 months, then you got a huge shortfall to make up for. On the other hand, if you plan for working for 4 months and you end up working 10, then you've got a huge bonus of money that you can use to put towards things like vacations or kids for college and all those kind of things. And it's far better to have too much money or more money than you expected than far less than you expected. That's always the case.
I like that when that happens. It usually yeah. Doesn't happen that way, but.
And like, you know, those of us who are employees think, oh, well, you know, the company is probably going to exist for the next year. I'm probably going to be there. But for contractors, it's much more precarious. So underestimating is a really good thing. And then the next thing that contractors might expect is to have consecutive contracts. So they might be thinking, okay, here's my next year. I know this contract's going to last 4 of these months because the go live date is on whatever, April the 30th. And it usually only takes me 3 weeks to get another contract. So I'll just account for those 3 weeks that I'm not going to be working and then assume that I'm going to work for the next part of the year, you know, the rest of the year. And so you only account for not being paid for 3 weeks. And that doesn't always happen. You know, there's stuff that you can control, like your skill set and the amount of time you're out prospecting and your network and all that kind of stuff. But there's things that you can't control, like what's going on in the economy or what's going down on in your industry or another industry that depends on your industry. And all of those things can mesh together to mean that you don't get continuous contracts, even if your skill set is in high demand.
Yeah, that's true, right? The company you're working for could have decided that in response to the move of a competitor that they need to move resources to a specific project that's not yours, that becomes strategic in value, and they have to save cost and they cut yours, right? So there's all sorts of things that can happen.
Yeah. And you and I talked on one of the previous casts for contractors and consultants about looking for particular contracts that provide an expansion of your skills or a step into management or whatever it is that you want to do in order that you get the progression that an employee enjoys. And you can't do that if you take the first contract that is offered to you. And if you haven't planned for being out of work, you will have to take the first contract because otherwise you can't pay any bills. And then you're taking contracts for the money and in desperation rather than being able to plan, this is what I'm looking for next. And I know I've got 3 months of money, and so I can wait for that contract.
That's right. You got to be more strategic in your selection and acceptance of contracts, right? And that strategicness, there's no such word, I'm sure, but that strategic nature of that decision takes time, right? Takes more thinking about what you want to do and what you need to do to get there, as well as prospecting to find the right opportunity. And you might have to go through several opportunities before you find the right one that a strategic fit. And that takes time. And so there might be another month that you're not working and you're prospecting to ensure that you have the long-term growth that you're looking for.
And of course, it's possible that you might be able to combine these times. You might be able to, if you work for 3 months and then you have 3 months off, you can have time off as vacation time. At the same time, you could still be prospecting because it doesn't necessarily need to take up a 40 or 50 hour week. You could be doing some training during that time and take the rest as vacation. So it doesn't necessarily have to be separate time. But if you are going to think, okay, I'm going to have the rule of thirds and I'm going to combine these two thirds, then you need to be working hard at making sure you're doing both in order to make sure that you are ready for what comes next.
Okay. Now we're working for a third time, so.
Yeah. So what else? So the next third is prospecting. So if you're lucky, you're working in an area where your skills are super hot and you're getting offers every day from competitors and recruiters. But even if you are, you know, we just said, that's not necessarily the contract that you want to take. When the market gets tight, when there are less people available and there are fewer candidates than there are openings, that proportion goes down. Recruiters tend to use like a spray, like a shotgun method. They'll send out a job to anybody who has even the vaguest skills related to the job description. Because the fewer people there are, the less people they have who have the right skills. And so even if you're getting job offers or job, you know, are you interested in this role kind of emails every day, that doesn't necessarily follow that those are good contracts for you or even roles that you could even do. So you can't judge your hotness by the number of emails you're getting. And so if you want the time to assess the contracts and to make sure that they're a fit for your skills and the path you want to take, you need to be able to be proactive in that process. And in some industries, you need to make a proposal or you need to respond to requests for proposals. There isn't an interview process. So especially for consultants, they tend to have to go through that proposal process and that takes longer. So even if you found something that's the right fit, if you have to go through a proposal process, it's probably another 6 weeks. Whereas contractors who do, say, IT contracting are usually pretty quick from somebody saying, do you want this job, to you being able to start in that job because networks and because of skill sets, it's much more defined. But for other people, it takes longer. And again, you need to have that time in order to make sure that you have time to go through that process without, you know, missing your electricity bill or something.
Right. I've had several friends who are contractors and let me tell you, when they get in a position where, and they've been, right, where they have to take the next job that's available because they haven't planned appropriately. And they take a contract and it's the wrong one. It's not strategic in the sense it doesn't get them where they want to go. And they knew pretty much up front that it was going to be miserable. And in fact, it is indeed miserable. And so a bad contract can be a real downer.
Yeah, and there's bad contracts for all sorts of reasons. The people you're working with, the systems you're working with, if you've agreed to a day rate, so you're paid per day that you're on site, and then you end up working 15 hours a day, that takes your hourly rate way down from what you might have said had you set it as an hourly rate. And, you know, I remember people thinking, you know, having conversations with people who were like, oh, £350 a day, excellent. And then they found out that they were working 15 hours a day, and that's below £30 an hour, which is not very much for an IT contractor. So again, if you're desperate and if you take bad contracts, you can find yourself not paid very well, doing something you don't like, working with people you don't like. You might be in a situation where the company has really strict rules of engagement and you can't go to any meetings, you can't go to lunch with anybody, you don't go to any parties. Paul was telling me a story. Paul, who works for you in our IT team, was telling me a story about a contract he did, and he was pivotal to the contract and the project being done. And at the end of the project, there was like a big blowout party for everybody who'd been in the project, and he wasn't allowed to go, despite the fact that everyone, including the CEO, said, without you, we wouldn't have done it. But the rules of engagement of the company said, no, you can't come to this party.
Yeah, there's a lot of these days goes back to, I guess, many, many years back to a judgment against Microsoft and treating contractors as employees and all that. So there's this desire to make a clear distinction between contractors and employees. For legal reasons. Anyways, it's unfortunate because at the end of a project, there's a lot of contractors, which there often is, you know, half the team's not there for the party, which is very unfortunate.
It sucks for everybody.
Yeah, it's awful. It's not good for anybody, frankly.
The other thing about bad contract is if you're working on a project that is known to be a failure, you know, and again, the people where contractors are working, it tends to be pretty well networked. So people tend to know about other projects and how they're going. And if you're known for being one of the people that worked on that bad contract that got cancelled or it failed or whatever, people will doubt whether or not you're good at your job because you were involved with it. You get kind of tarred by association. That's another reason not to take bad contracts.
That's a great point. And it applies not only to contractors, but it applies to employees as well, right? If often you have some influence, not always, but you have some influence as to what projects you get placed on. And picking those, you know, they're kind of like widow makers, right? Jobs that, you know, frankly, everybody who takes a job fails at it, and then they're tarred for life. Yeah. And so I wasn't always successful, but I tried very hard in my career not to take jobs that were almost just a sheer sentence of managerial or executive death because they were impossible. So as a contractor, it behooves you even more to pay attention to that kind of stuff. Sometimes it's hard to judge, right? If you're going to a company that you have no previous relationship with, you have no experience with, you don't know anybody else on the team. You don't know who's managing the project. You know, it's going to be hard to determine what are the chances of success. Of course, if you're like a lot of contractors, you get into a particular company and you go from project to project within a company, you can start to use your network to determine the likelihood of a particular project being successful, and therefore either influencing your reputation positively or negatively.
Exactly. I was just thinking while you were saying that, where would you find out about other people's contracts? And I've seen hundreds, I think, of groups on LinkedIn for particular skills. So there'll be like a Drupal developers group and a C++ group and stuff. That would be a good place to start if you wanted to get a network of people who had similar skills and they were forward doing similar things on similar projects.
Yeah, you know, again, it goes to the value of your network, right? Which mm-hmm. is not only in terms of finding opportunities, but also getting intelligence about opportunities and things that are going on. And, you know, and there are project managers and managers out there who are regularly successful. And if you have an opportunity to work on a project, with one of them is probably, you know, a good bet. So I don't think professionals, whether they be employees or contractors, spend enough time thinking about that, getting on projects that are going to be successful and build your reputation. So anyway, so the best way to avoid all this stuff is to make sure that you've allocated time to do this kind of research, to go to your network, get intelligence, right, and build time into your year to do the appropriate amount of prospecting to ensure that you get on the right projects that move you in the right direction relative to your career.
Exactly.
Okay. And then, so that's 2/3 of our time. So what's the other third of our time? Vacation?
Yeah, you wish. The last third is professional development. And we're going to divide the professional development into three. So there's expertise training. So training on skills that you already have or skills that you want to develop. There's business training, as in the training you need to run a business. And there's client management training, because you may not have a boss, but you have clients, and clients can be worse than having bosses, and you need to learn how to manage them. For example, I looked up some stats. Let's talk about the expertise training, and I'll give you an example. So say you're a Drupal developer and you've been working for big companies helping to install really big content management systems. Well, there's only about 750,000 Drupal installs right now, and they nearly always need a developer. But after a while, all the big companies around you are going to have their systems in place, and the jobs for doing the original install are going to disappear. They're going to be all maintenance jobs, and maybe that's not what you want to do. So unless you start traveling, it's going to be harder to find those kind of jobs, and maybe you want to stay in the same neighborhood because you have kids or whatever. And so you tap into your network and you find out, hey, there's a bunch of WordPress installs. There's actually nearly 75 million WordPress installs, which is like 2 orders of magnitude. I don't know, it's a lot more. And so if you haven't set any time aside for professional development, you're in the trap of only being able to do those Drupal installs and therefore having to travel or having to do maintenance that you don't want to do because you like the setup part. So during your professional development time, during that third of whatever time you're looking at, you could do some work on learning how to do WordPress installs. And maybe you only do them because they're so much smaller. Maybe you only do them for small businesses in your neighborhood in between other jobs. But at least then you've worked on another skill so that you're not trapping yourself in only having one skill.
Yeah, it's an interesting decision-making process around what skills to focus on, right? Do you become more broad in your skill set and able to do more stuff, or do you delve in deeper and become the go-to guy or gal when it comes to Drupal, right? And that's a discussion that's beyond the context of this particular discussion, but that's part of your strategic planning is what is your value in the marketplace, right? And how are you going to attack that? Are you going to be the general practitioner, or are you going to be the person who has in-depth, detailed knowledge of a specific technology?
Exactly. And one way to think about it is to be T-shaped. So you're really deep in one thing, like Drupal, but you understand a bunch of other things, because then you can work with a bunch of other people.
T-shaped. I hadn't heard that description before.
There you go. I taught you something.
I like that. I'm more S-shaped. People can figure out what that means, but unfortunately.
Indecisive.
I was thinking more of physical, but anyways.
Oh, I see.
Too much information, Mike. Nobody wants to know that.
We can go there, but no. Okay, so the next card, that's expertise training. And then business training is the training that you need to run a business. And if you're an employee, you generally don't have to worry about taxes and social security and invoicing and a million other things that business owners have to think about, like, what kind of business am I going to have? Like, which legal entity do I need to be? If you're in the UK, there's a lot of worry about umbrellas and whether or not you need an umbrella, which will make sense to everybody in the UK and nobody else.
Yeah, I'm thinking, is it raining? I know that's not what you mean, but yeah, I get it.
Yeah, it's legal entities, but it's interesting. But as a business owner, you may need to take professional development classes in that kind of thing, like, are online courses or courses given by tax authorities about how you should properly run your company, both to be within the law and to take advantage of the law.
That's right.
And all of us think about taking advantage of our taxes, but nobody really worries about actually doing it legally, which is required to.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, business training is important, right? Even if it's just you, you're a small business owner and all the responsibilities that go with that. And you're your own marketing person, salesperson, you're your own finance person, you're your own tax person to some extent. Obviously, you need to get an accountant or a tax attorney to help you with that kind of stuff. If you want to be successful and grow your business, you have to have a pretty broad business knowledge that you may not have to if you were working for, as an employee somewhere for a company and didn't have to worry about all that. So yeah, behoove you to learn all that.
And the worst time to start learning is right before taxes are due, because nobody wants to have a long conversation with you then. So when you're planning your third that you've divided into a third for business training, you probably want to make sure that that's in a time of the year when those kind of things are happening, because the kind of professions that you need to deal with are in their slow periods.
Right. And we haven't talked about client management yet, but that's, of course, if you're a software developer, that, doing your technical, engaging your technical skills is a part of it. But you may not have a boss, but you have clients, and clients have to be managed.
Indeed. And a client management is hard because you want them to give you money for your skills and they have to give you money for their skills. But that whole negotiation thing and the differences in power and all that stuff makes those relationships difficult. But there's two reasons for doing client management. First, you are able to manage your clients to make the relationship work. And the better the relationship, the better all the other things will go. Negotiations about money or project statuses or deliverables, all those kind of things go better if the better relationship you have.
Right. Not to mention your network and your reputation, right? I mean, in the end, it doesn't matter how perfect your developer, how perfect your code is or how well commented it is, right? But what's important is, regardless of the quality of your code, is how happy is your client? And if the code, this is going to strike people wrong, but if your code is total crap and your client is thrilled with you and praises you up and down to everybody he or she knows, well, okay, that's not a bad thing. Now, I suspect that your code being crap is not going to get you that kind of glowing reputation, but you get my point.
Indeed. And the other thing, if you have those skills, the relationship building skills and managing relationships and all those kind of things, you can use those skills with all of the people around you. It doesn't necessarily mean your client, but if you're working on a project, that project will have internal clients within a company, and you can use those skills with those people, again, to build relationships. And if you're the person who's really good at that and you are helping the project get done and move through its stages smoothly, that will get noticed as much as whether or not you write good code or whatever else your expertise is in.
Yeah, I think the thing to mention here is also is that for those of you who are familiar with DISC, D-I-S-C, which is a behavioral profiling instrument, if you're familiar with that, you'll know that we have different, I want to say personality profiles. It's not a personality profile, but we have
tendencies
in terms of our behaviors. And for a lot of folks in some industries, like if you're a technical person or you're an accountant or a scientist or an engineer, you tend to be reserved and more into the details and less, I don't mean this to insult you, but less of a people person than other folks. A lot of engineers are not naturally gregarious. So this client management stuff may involve skills that you're not naturally attuned to. And it'd be wise to know, based on whatever your industry you're in, is what your strengths and weaknesses are and work on, if you're not naturally outgoing, you don't have to be the greatest salesperson in the world. I'm not suggesting that you spend so much time on your weaknesses that you don't capitalize on your strengths, but at least work at a point where it's not a deterrent in terms of your success. For example, somebody who's in the marketing side, for example, and I've known plenty of people like this who are consulting on the marketing side, they're great. They're outgoing people. They're friendly. Everybody loves them. And then they fall down because they do great work, people are really happy, and they don't bill for the next 4 months.
Right? Oh,
right? And get
yes.
the details. So they're not the kind of detail-oriented person. And so the relationship falls down because they're completely unreliable in terms of submitting expenses or billing the customer or those kind of myriad of things that have to happen for the company to interact with you. So I just want to be of our technical people. Each of us have our strengths and weaknesses, and they can impact our career in many ways. So, you know, we talked about a number of things to focus on in terms of your skills directly related to what you do, business skills, client management skills, and there are others. But think about where you are and what your strengths and weaknesses are, and that might help you figure out where you might have a tendency to fall down in this business of yours being a contractor.
And where you might need someone else's help.
Yeah, absolutely.
And one thing I've noticed is I'm fascinated by people who do their jobs really well. I don't care what the job is, but I have this little obsession with finding out how people who are really good at their jobs do it. And every single time I've noticed that the people who are really good really think about what it is they're doing and what the best way to do it is. So if you know someone who just gets the best contracts and their clients love them and they are able to dictate terms, I bet they'll be thinking on this kind of level about what it is they're doing.
Yeah, it's a good point, right? They're thinking about I'm a process kind of driven guy. So I think about the process, right? I'd have a process diagram for every piece of this whole thing in terms of what are the inputs, what are the outputs, what are the things I need to do, what are my measurements? Okay, it'd be drive people crazy. But yeah, you're right. People who are good appear to the outside to do it intuitively, to like just be a natural. And the fact is they're not, generally speaking, a natural. They've just thought really deep about it and spend time getting incrementally better day after day, week after week, month after month.
Exactly. And they put aside time to do that.
Excellent. Awesome. Thanks, Wendy.
Thanks. Bye, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. That's it. We'll see you next week. So long. If you enjoyed this podcast and you want the how-tos of management wherever you are, check out the free Manager Tools mobile app. It's available on both iOS and Android devices. Go to the Apple Store or the Google Play Store and download the Manager Tools app. Just search for Manager Tools in the respective store, or go to the Manager Tools website, www.manager-tools.com, and you'll find the links on the bottom of the homepage. Once you've installed the Manager Tools app, you'll have access to all the Manager Tools and Career Tools shows anytime, anywhere you want. With easy searching of podcasts by category, using the map of the universe, or using built-in search functions, it couldn't be easier. Additionally, if you're a Manager Tools personal licensee, you'll have easy access to all the show notes right from the app whenever you want. Go to the App Store and download the Manager Tools mobile app. You'll be happy you did.